In a culture obsessed with productivity and constant activity, Joseph Piper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture, arrives like a revolutionary manifesto. Written in post-war Germany in 1947, this philosophical gem has become a touchstone for intellectuals seeking to escape the suffocating grip of what Piper calls total work. The book has influenced figures ranging from Pope Benedict XVI to tech entrepreneur Naval Ravikant, who credits it with reshaping his approach to time and success. Despite being over 70 years old, its message resonates even more powerfully today in our hyper-connected, always-on world where burnout has become an epidemic. As the New York Times noted in a recent retrospective, Piper's work anticipated our modern crisis of meaning long before smartphones made leisure nearly impossible. The very foundation of Western culture rests on a concept we've almost completely forgotten: leisure. It's no linguistic accident that the Greek word for skole evolved into our word for school. For the ancients, leisure wasn't merely free time or recreation. It was the basis of education, contemplation, and culture itself. Aristotle's declaration that we are unleisurely in order to have leisure would sound utterly backward to modern ears. We've completely inverted this relationship, embracing the maxim, one lives to work, instead. This fundamental shift has profound implications for how we structure our lives, educate our children, and understand human flourishing. This reversal represents a profound shift in our understanding of human nature. The classical distinction between liberal arts, activities worthy of free persons, and servile work, activities performed out of necessity, has collapsed. In ancient Greece and Rome, activities like mathematics, philosophy, and music were considered noble pursuits precisely because they served no practical purpose. Even our religious traditions reflect this ancient understanding. The prohibition against servile work on the Sabbath wasn't about avoiding physical labor, but about preserving space for activities that transcend mere utility. The Jewish concept of Shabbat and similar practices in other traditions emphasize this dedication to higher pursuits. What makes our modern predicament particularly troubling is how completely work has colonized domains once considered beyond its reach. Philosophy and intellectual pursuits were traditionally viewed as privileged spheres separate from labor, but now they've been subsumed under what Piper calls the totalitarian claims of the work ideal. When we speak of intellectual work, academic productivity, or research outputs, we reveal how thoroughly the language and logic of productivity have infiltrated even our most contemplative activities. Universities, once sanctuaries of contemplation, now operate increasingly like corporations, measuring success through metrics and deliverables. This shift reflects a fundamental change in our understanding of knowledge itself. Where ancient thinkers recognized contemplation as primarily receptive, like simply beholding a rose, Kant declared knowledge to be exclusively discursive, an active process of examining, relating, and demonstrating. Knowledge became something we produce through effort rather than something we receive through openness. This transformation has deep implications for education, where active learning and measurable outcomes have largely replaced contemplative study and the pursuit of wisdom for its own sake. Even meditation and mindfulness, ancient practices of receptive awareness, are now often marketed as productivity tools for better work performance. The consequences of this shift extend into our everyday lives, where leisure has been reduced to mere entertainment or recovery time between work periods. Activities that don't contribute to productivity or career advancement are often seen as wasteful or indulgent, rather than essential to human development and cultural flourishing. This mindset has created a society where even our free time is increasingly structured, scheduled, and oriented towards self-improvement or future utility. Medieval thinkers recognized two complementary aspects of understanding: ratio, discursive, logical thought, and intellectus, simple, intuitive vision. While ratio involves active effort, the properly human element in knowledge, intellectus is receptive, passive, and contemplative. Though ratio was considered superhuman, it remained essential to human knowledge, as we participate in what Aquinas called the angelic faculty of non-discursive vision. This dual nature of understanding acknowledges both our analytical capabilities and our innate capacity for direct insight, much like how we instantly recognize a familiar face without conscious analysis. The modern view that knowledge is work makes two radical claims. First, that one must work to know, the claim on man. Second, that knowledge is exclusively the fruit of human effort, with nothing given about it, the claim by man. This leads to the tense, strained face of the intellectual worker, marked by perpetual activity that ends in bankruptcy, as Goethe observed. We see this manifested in contemporary academia's emphasis on publication metrics, citation counts, and the relentless pursuit of novel research, often at the expense of deeper understanding and wisdom. Our obsession with difficulty as a measure of value traces back to Antisthenes, who made Hercules the human ideal for his superhuman labors. But Aquinas countered this view. The essence of virtue consists in the good rather than in the difficult. True knowledge and virtue come effortlessly, like gifts, not because effort isn't required in preparation, but because their essence lies in grasping reality and realizing the good, not in the struggle itself. Consider how great discoveries often come in moments of relaxation. Archimedes in his bath, Newton under the apple tree, or Einstein during his daydreams. The modern fixation on difficulty reflects our fundamental mistrust of the effortless and our refusal to accept anything as a gift, a view diametrically opposed to Christianity's emphasis on grace. We've become suspicious of anything that comes too easily, as though value must be measured by exertion rather than by truth or goodness. This manifests in our education systems, where we often privilege complexity over clarity, and in our work culture, where long hours are seen as virtuous regardless of productivity. The contemporary hustle culture exemplifies this mindset, celebrating constant busyness while overlooking the vital role of receptivity and contemplation in genuine understanding. This rejection of effortless knowledge has profound implications for learning and creativity. Just as a musician must balance technical practice with intuitive performance, or a writer must alternate between careful editing and spontaneous inspiration, true understanding requires both active effort and receptive openness. The medieval synthesis of ratio and intellectus offers a more balanced approach, recognizing that some of our most valuable insights come not through forceful striving, but through patient attention and openness to truth. Leisure stands in complete opposition to the worker ideal in three fundamental ways. First, leisure implies non-activity and inward calm, not being busy, but letting things happen. It requires silence, not mere noiselessness, but the soul's receptive power to answer reality undisturbed. This contemplative attitude allows one to steep oneself in the whole of creation with serenity, embracing the mysterious nature of the universe with deep confidence. Unlike the restless activity that characterizes the modern mind, leisure allows things to unfold naturally. As Conrad Weiss noted, there is confidence in the fragmentariness of life and history, contrasting with Ernst Jünger's cold dissection of mystery through tidy formulas. True leisure means being open rather than intervening, loosening the reins rather than grabbing hold, similar to falling asleep, which requires letting oneself go. Second, leisure is an attitude of contemplative celebration. It draws vitality from affirmation, consenting to one's true nature and abiding in concord with the universe's meaning. Like lovers' tranquil silence drawing strength from concord, leisure celebrates the basic meaningfulness of existence. Just as God beheld creation and saw it was very good, in leisure we affirm, it is good. The festival represents leisure's essence, uniting tranquility, contemplation, and intensity of life. Third, leisure stands perpendicular to work as social function. Unlike breaks taken for work's sake, leisure exists on a different plane entirely. It cuts across work vertically, as intellectus, intuition, relates to eternity, while ratio relates to time. Leisure doesn't exist to restore working powers, though it does renew strength, but to ensure the functionary remains fully human, capable of grasping the world as a whole. Through leisure, we access superhuman, life-giving existential forces that open a gate to freedom from the latent anxiety marking the world of work. As Aristotle observed, in leisure, man lives not to the extent that he is a man, but to the extent that a divine principle dwells within him. The practical challenge becomes whether we can defend or reconquer leisure against the invading claims of total labor. This isn't merely about preserving Sunday afternoon idleness, but protecting the preserve of freedom, education, culture, and undiminished humanity that views the world as a whole. In our hyper-connected age, where work emails follow us home and side hustles are normalized, this challenge has become increasingly urgent and complex. A proletarian is not simply a poor person. Medieval beggars weren't proletarians. Nor is a proletarian necessarily poor. Specialists in a totalitarian work state are proletarians despite their income. Rather, the proletarian is one who is fettered to the process of work, the vast utilitarian process serving public need, where the worker's life is wholly consumed. This definition encompasses both factory workers and high-powered executives who cannot separate their identity from their professional role. This fettering occurs through three distinct but interrelated causes: lack of property, the propertyless wage earner who must sell his capacity to work, state coercion in totalitarian systems where everyone becomes subject to economic forces, and inner impoverishment, where life contracts until one can neither act nor conceive of anything beyond work. These forms mutually reinforce each other. The total work state needs spiritually impoverished functionaries who find illusory fulfillment in service. Modern examples include the gig economy worker dependent on platforms, the corporate employee bound by golden handcuffs, and the entrepreneur who sacrifices all personal life for business success. This proletarian mindset extends beyond the working class to all levels of society. Even highly paid professionals can be proletarians if their entire existence is consumed by their function. Doctors working 80-hour weeks, lawyers billing endless hours, and tech workers living at their offices all exemplify this condition. The distinction between liberal and servile arts becomes crucial. Servile arts being directed to the satisfaction of a need through activity. Liberal arts, by contrast, cultivate the whole person and serve no immediate practical purpose. Deproletarianization requires expanding life beyond merely useful work by combining property ownership opportunities, limiting state power, and overcoming inner impoverishment. This might involve promoting employee ownership programs, protecting time for contemplation and creativity, and fostering communities that value non-productive activities. The challenge is particularly acute in an era where technology enables constant productivity monitoring and work increasingly colonizes private life. We must not deny work's servility by pretending it doesn't primarily serve external purposes. Such fiction establishes the inhuman state of labor under totalitarianism, ultimately tying workers to production as life's supposed meaning. True deproletarianization requires recognizing the distinction between useful activity, whose purpose lies outside itself, and liberal arts that cannot be reduced to utility. This means acknowledging that our worth as humans extends far beyond our economic output, and creating spaces, both physical and temporal, where non-instrumental activities can flourish. What ultimately makes leisure both possible and justifiable? The soul of leisure lies in celebration, the point where relaxation, effortlessness, and the superiority of active leisure to all functions converge. But if celebration forms leisure's core, then leisure can only be justified on the same basis as a festival. That basis is divine worship. Divine worship means the same thing where time is concerned as the temple where space is concerned. Temple means a particular piece of ground specially reserved and marked off from land used for agriculture or habitation. This plot is transferred to the god's estate, neither lived on nor cultivated. Similarly, divine worship sets aside a certain space of time from working hours, a limited time, specially marked off and withdrawn from utilitarian ends. Every seventh day represents such a period, festival time, arising in this way and no other. There can be no such thing in the world of total labor as space not used on principle, no plot of ground or period of time withdrawn from use. The worker's world rests solely on rational utilization. A feast day in that world is either a pause for the sake of work or, like Labor Day, a celebration of work itself. There might be games and circuses, but who would describe mass entertainment as festal? The world of work is impoverished regardless of material goods because on a utilitarian basis, genuine wealth, which implies overflowing into superfluities, becomes impossible. Divine worship, however, creates real wealth through sacrifice, its living heart. Sacrifice means voluntary offering freely given, antithetical to utility. It creates wealth that cannot be consumed by the workaday world, establishing an area where calculation is abandoned and goods deliberately squandered. Separated from divine worship, leisure becomes laziness and work inhuman. The vacancy left by absence of worship fills with mere killing of time and boredom. As Baudelaire cynically noted in his journal, one must work, if not from taste, then at least from despair. For, to reduce everything to a single truth, work is less boring than pleasure. The philosophical act represents a fundamental shift in human orientation, a stepping beyond the confines of the workaday world. Unlike scientific inquiry, which begins with preliminary questions before experimentation, asking what does philosophizing mean is itself already philosophy. This question occurs not before or after the philosophical enterprise, but in its very midst, for one cannot speak about philosophy without simultaneously addressing man's nature and his relationship to knowledge, truth, and reality itself. Like all philosophical questions, this one cannot be answered with finality. Philosophical answers are not what Parmenides called neatly rounded truths that can be picked like apples. They are more like horizons that continuously expand as we approach them. Philosophy's entire structure differs. It is conditioned by hope and driven by an endless quest for understanding rather than definitive conclusions. To philosophize means stepping out of the workaday world, the utilitarian realm of useful functions, demand and supply, hunger and satiety. This world is dominated by a single end, satisfying the common need through work. In this realm, actions are valued primarily for their practical outcomes, building shelter, producing food, creating tools. But common need differs fundamentally from common good. While the former represents essential needs for survival and comfort, the common good encompasses much more, including what Aquinas called the useless life of contemplation. It includes art, music, literature, and philosophical inquiry, activities that may not contribute directly to material well-being, but enrich human existence in profound ways. The common good requires that some people philosophize, though philosophy doesn't satisfy common needs. Philosophy's freedom lies in its uselessness. It is what Newman called the knowledge of a gentleman, not functional knowledge, but free knowledge, pursued for its own sake rather than for practical application. This knowledge isn't legitimized by usefulness or social function, but by its intrinsic value in expanding human understanding and consciousness. This is the meaning of liberal in liberal arts. Those not ordered to satisfy practical needs through activity, but aimed at cultivating the mind and spirit. Unlike sciences, philosophy cannot be put at the disposal of external ends. While governments might reasonably say, we need physicists trained in particular branches, or we need medical researchers to cure the flu, they cannot say, we need philosophers to elaborate this ideology without strangling philosophy itself. The same applies to poetry and other creative pursuits. Philosophy and poetry contain their own ends and cannot serve as means to other purposes without losing their essential nature. They represent the highest form of intellectual freedom, the pursuit of truth and beauty for their own sake, unrestricted by practical demands or utilitarian considerations. This liberation from immediate utility allows philosophy to examine fundamental questions about existence, knowledge, ethics, and the nature of reality itself. Questions that might seem impractical, but are essential to human understanding and development. Through this useless pursuit, philosophy helps us understand not just how to live, but why we live, contributing to human wisdom in ways that transcend mere practical utility. Unlike animals perfectly adapted to their sharply defined environments, but simultaneously imprisoned within them, humans possess spirit, the capacity to establish relationships with the totality of being. Spirit, by its very nature, breaks the bounds of any environment, abolishing both adaptation and imprisonment. As Aristotle wrote, the soul is, fundamentally, everything that is. The spiritual soul is meant to fit in with all being. Spirit exists not in a world or its world, but in the world, the whole of reality. Yet humans are not pure spirit, but finite spirit. The world coordinated to spirit is indeed man's world, but the essence of things is not given to him fully and completely. Man is essentially corporeal spiritual, a fusion of plant, animal, and spiritual life. Therefore, he cannot live exclusively face to face with the totality of reality. He needs both world and environment. He cannot permanently dwell beneath the stars, but requires the familiar roof, everyday surroundings, and habits. The truly human condition is to see the stars above the roof, to preserve our apprehension of universality amid daily habits. Philosophizing means experiencing how our immediate surroundings can and must be broken in upon by the call of the world. This philosophical act is, as Aquinas said of contemplation, not properly human, but superhuman. Wonder, that profound, receptive astonishment at the very fact that things are, constitutes the true beginning of philosophy. This wonder is not merely a starting point, but the lasting source of all genuine philosophizing. It combines both negative and positive aspects. Negatively, it acknowledges our incomplete knowledge. Positively, it actively seeks understanding through a desire for knowledge. Unlike God, who knows perfectly, and animals who lack the capacity to seek causes, humans alone can truly wonder. This gives wonder the same structure as hope. We are travelers, not yet possessing full understanding, but actively seeking it. The sciences may cease wondering when they reach conclusions, but the philosopher never stops wondering, for philosophical questions about essences can never be fully answered. Philosophy cannot form a closed system that claims to have captured ultimate reality. Any philosophy that presents itself as a completed system contradicts the very nature of philosophizing as an ongoing quest. The philosopher must remain open to the inexhaustible mystery of being, maintaining the tension between knowledge and wonder, between what can be grasped and what remains beyond our full comprehension. This dynamic tension is exemplified in the Socratic paradox of knowing that one does not know, which becomes not a resignation but a catalyst for continued inquiry. philosophy has always been preceded by traditional interpretations of the world, emerging from the rich soil of cultural and religious understanding. The great founders of Western philosophy, Plato and Aristotle, not only recognized these pre-existing traditions, but accepted them as their starting points. Plato considered these ancient traditions as divine in origin, handed down by our forefathers, as evidenced in his dialogues like Timaeus and Phaedrus. Philosophy stands in a contrapuntal relationship with theology, receiving its impulse from a prior interpretation of reality while maintaining its independence through questioning concrete experience. This relationship can be seen in how medieval philosophers engaged with religious texts while developing their own systematic inquiries. In the Western world since classical times, Christian theology has become the primary pre-philosophical tradition concerning the world as a whole. The vitality of philosophy depends on maintaining its contrapuntal relationship with theology, where it draws existential salt. When philosophy becomes a shriveled intellectual discipline for specialists, disconnected from these deeper wellsprings, it loses its power to illuminate human experience and address fundamental questions of existence. This can be observed in the contrast between the vibrant philosophical traditions of Augustine and Aquinas versus the more sterile academic philosophies that sometimes emerge in purely secular contexts. Contrary to popular belief, Christian philosophy isn't distinguished by having ready answers. Rather, it more fully grasps the sense of wonder rooted in ignorance, exemplified in Augustine's assertion that if you comprehend it, it is not God. Its distinguishing mark is being inspired by mystery. Even revealed truths of Christianity remain partly hidden, creating a productive tension between faith and reason. The advantage of Christian philosophy lies in seeing the world in its real character as unfathomable mystery, while simultaneously providing a framework for meaningful engagement with that mystery. Christianity isn't merely doctrine, but reality. A Christian philosopher must be deeply rooted in Christian reality, not just harmonizing natural and supernatural knowledge theoretically. As Aquinas distinguished, beyond conceptual knowledge lies knowledge through existential affinity. Knowing divine things as one's own is only possible for one who has not just learned Christianity, but suffered and experienced its reality. This experiential dimension transforms philosophical inquiry from an abstract intellectual exercise into a lived engagement with truth, combining theoretical rigor with spiritual insight. The Christian philosopher thus operates in a unique space where reason and faith, experience and reflection, mystery and understanding converge in a dynamic interplay.